Morning, everyone. I should have introduced myself earlier. My name is Matt. I'm one of the pastors here. Our normal preaching pastor, Jason, is in Seattle getting to visit family, but it is a pleasure to be with you to get the opportunity to preach. It's been a little over a year and a half, but I'm still a relatively new dad. I've learned a lot in the last year and a half, and I'm still learning, and I imagine I will learn, as I'm sure it's a lifelong lesson, really. But something that I wish I was farther along in my parenting than what I am right now is being able to diagnose Micah's problems. Because as a 1.5-year-old, he's starting to talk, but he's not so advanced that he can describe what is going on with him. Because no matter what the problem is, the symptom is crying, right? That's crying. You check, you know, whether he's, you know, has a dirty diaper or he's tired or he's hungry. Those are the big three. But no matter what the root of the problem is, the symptom is always crying. That's what it is. And so Glenna, you know, she's farther along in this process than I am, but she has made the wishful remark several times, I just wish he could talk, or I just wish I could be inside his head to know what's wrong. Because until we get at the root of the problem, the solution is just going to be futile, right? It's just, we can give him food, but if he's not hungry, it doesn't matter. It's not going to cure the problem. It's not going to stop the crime. So until we get at the root of the problem by diagnosing the problem, the solution is not going to happen, and there will be no satisfaction on our end as parents, kind of to our wits' end with a crying baby, but also on Micah's end, too. So in other words, we need to be able to diagnose the correct problem in order to arrive at a satisfactory solution. Today in our text, we'll be in Matthew chapter 14, and in it we see that the disciples diagnose the problem as one thing and propose a certain solution, but Jesus gets at the heart of the matter and provides a satisfactory solution. So will you stand? We'll be reading from Matthew chapter 14, verses 13 through 21. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food. Jesus replied, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men, besides women and children. You may be seated. So again, we have here a problem. There is a problem. And the disciples are going to look at the problem and they're going to see one thing. And Jesus is going to look at the problem and see another. And based on how they diagnose the problem, their solutions vary. So at first we're going to look at the diagnosed problem. That is the diagnosed problem according to the disciples. Now before we even get into what they think the problem is, we need to go back and reset the scene. What in the scene is cluing them into that, number one, there's a problem, and number two, what that problem is exactly. So as we look down to verse 13, we say, when Jesus heard what happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Now, the word that's actually there is, you know, some translations go with solitary, some go with desolate, but the word that's actually there is desert or wilderness. He is withdrawing into a desert or a wilderness. This place is uninhabited. And before long, in verses 14, we see that the crowds begin to follow him. So there's lots of people. There's lots of people in this desert or this wilderness that's uninhabited, and there are no supplies. In verse 17, we see the disciples, they say, "Hey, we've been looking around, and all we see here are 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. A desert wilderness that's uninhabited with lots and lots of people, no supplies, and we see that night is coming after a long day of healing. Verses 14 and 15. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, So evening is approaching. Now that word is flexible enough to be anywhere from evening to a little bit more kind of mid-afternoon. So at this point in time, it's probably that it's mid-afternoon, but the disciples are projecting forward. They're saying, wait a second, look where we are. Nothing's around. Look at how many people there are. No supplies. And night is coming after a long day of healing. So they begin to put two and two together and they decide, you know what the problem is? These people are physically hungry and they were sick. But Jesus, he's answered that. So they're physically hungry. Maybe there are some complainers in the crowd. I don't know. It doesn't go into that. You know, they're describing how hungry they are. Maybe their stomachs are growling, and maybe they can even hear their neighbor's stomach growling, as you normally will hear later on as the church service goes. But they at least know themselves. They're like, wait a second, I'm hungry. It's been a while since I've had some food. I'm sure my neighbor is too. So they're diagnosing. They're seeing, all right, based on the scene that we have here, these people are physically hungry, and at least at one point in time, they were physically sick. So they arrive with a solution. They propose a solution to Jesus. They get together, and this is their proposed solution. Hey, we need to get food by departing for a food source. Okay, so verse 15, look down there. It says, as evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, this is a remote, or again, a desert or a wilderness place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so that they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food. Because when you have hunger, the only way that in their minds they're going to arrive at satisfaction is by adding food to the equation. And so since there are no deliveries out in the wilderness, no Snickers bars, they have assessed the situation. They've decided that, you know what? These people need to get out of here and get some food. So they need to go to the food source. The food cannot be brought to them. They need to go. The healing show, which they understood about the healing show, they knew that Jesus was going around healing people. It seems to have come and conquered. Everyone seems to be healed. It's time to move on so they can get some food. And notice they have scouted out alternatives, because in verse 17, they say, you know, we have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. So they've been looking around at the crowds and they know what they have to work with. And they recognize it is a meager supply, a small supply, not nearly big enough for a large crowd. And notice that their solution does have some precedent, that they have some precedent. If you want to flip back to Matthew chapter 8, there is some precedent for the crowds breaking up after the healing show has been completed. chapter 8 is very, very key for this passage. So we'll begin in chapter 8, verses 16 through 18. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Okay, just end right there. Now, these are all the connections between these two passages. First of all, it's evening or late afternoon. Jesus is healing. Jesus is seeing. He's specifically seeing what they're calling crowds. He's giving orders, which Matthew only uses of Jesus for this particular word 2 times, here and there. And he says, it's time to depart. Okay, it's time to depart. And so the disciples had seen Jesus do this in the past. So they're thinking, healing's done. Jesus' job is done. It's time to get out of here. We need to get some food. So it's very similar. But notice that that wasn't in a desert or a wilderness. And Jesus had more in store for this particular day. The problem did not really lie in the disciples' solution. The problem really lied with their diagnosis. These people were more than just physically hungry and sick. You see, the actual problem, as Jesus sees it, is yes, the people were physically hungry, and at one point they were sick, but those were symptoms of their spiritual hunger and sickness. Think about it. Why do we get hungry? Why do we get hungry? We know biologically the explanation for why we get hungry, but ultimately there is an underlying theology for why we get hungry. I'll read from here. This is a book by John Piper. It's called A Hunger for God. It's really about fasting, but this is a great quote when he asks, at the very beginning, why did God create bread and hunger? One of the reasons food has this amazing power is that it is so basic to our existence. Why is this? I mean, why did God create bread and design human beings to need it for life? He could have created life that has no need of food. He is God. He could have done it in any way he pleased. Why bread? And why hunger and thirst? My answer is very simple. He created bread so that we would have some idea of what the Son of God is like when he says, I am the bread of life, from John 6:35. And he created the rhythm of thirst and satisfaction so that we would have some idea of what faith in Christ is like when Jesus said, "He who believes in me shall never thirst," John 6:35. God did not have to create beings who need food and water and who have capacities for pleasant tastes. Fasting and hunger and thirst were created for the glory of Christ, which means that bread magnifies Christ in two ways, by being eaten with gratitude for his goodness and by being forfeited out of hunger for God himself. When we eat, we taste the emblem of our heavenly food, the bread of life. And when we fast, we say, "I love the reality above the emblem." Why are these people physically hungry and physically sick? It's because that's a mere symptom of their spiritual hunger and their spiritual sickness. Hunger is a built-in, God-ordained feeling that's designed to show us our need for God and his sustaining. Remember Jesus, as Jason, it's been a little while when we were in chapter 4, but Jesus in the temptation narrative from Matthew chapter 4 quotes from Deuteronomy chapter 8, and he says what? "Man will not live on bread alone, but from every word that comes from the mouth of God." So this hunger, this problem is that Jesus sees that the people, and by and large even the disciples at this point, are not living from every word that comes from the mouth of God. They're living by their meal day by day by day. And thus, the problem goes to more than just they need to go out and get the food source. So this is why Jesus' solution is the satisfactory solution. Only by adding Jesus to the equation do we arrive at satisfaction, not mere food. No departure is necessary because the food source is here. Notice from our passage, the word "here" is subtle, but it actually features pretty prominently from verses 15 through 18. It's in 17 and 18, but just to provide the context again, 15 through 18. "As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, 'This is a remote place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food.' Jesus replied, 'They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat.' 'We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish,' they answered. 'Bring them here to me,' Jesus said." So in other words, when the disciples look around at the supplies, what do they see? They see 5 loaves and they say 2 fish. So they think that there's nothing else here besides 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. And what does Jesus say? "Bring them here to me." In other words, he's wanting them to focus on the fact that he is there, that the source for everything that they need is already there. There's no need to depart and go out for this food source, that he is here, the Messiah is here. But let's also look at the miracle, because the miracle is at the heart of this satisfactory solution. Notice that there's an escalation. Verse 17, "We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish." So we see the food quantity. The food quantity is very meager. It's very small. And we see that all eat and are satisfied in verse 20. "They all ate and were satisfied." Now, if you were reading this passage for the first time, or you were hearing this story told for the first time, notice they haven't said how many people have eaten until the very, very end. So at this point, the word "crowd" has been used 5 times, but it's never been used to say there are this many people here. And why is that? Well, because you're left to wonder, well, how many people are there? Because one person's crowd is one person's intimate gathering. So you don't know exactly how many people are there, but you know, well, with only 5 loaves and 2 fish, this is sounding pretty impressive already. But then it keeps escalating. Look at verse 20, the rest of it. That they all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. So if you're hearing this story for the first time, you're beginning to do the math. You're like, wait a second. Crowds ate. They were satisfied. There were only 5 loaves and 2 fish to start, and somehow there are 12 basketfuls left over? What sort of party trick is Jesus doing here? And then finally, you get to verse 21, and you're blown away by this miracle. Verse 21, "The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men besides women and children." Now, that could mean that there were strictly just men in the crowd, that there were only 5,000 men, which would be impressive enough. Okay, there's impressive if you're going to feed 5,000 men. But the most natural way to read this is that the women and children were not counted in this quick census that they did. So in other words, we can speculate as to how many there were. You know, it's at least 5,000 people. So this miracle keeps escalating. You're like, what? 5,000 people? 5 loaves and 2 fish fed 5,000 people, fed them to the point that they even had leftovers, and there are 5,000. So it keeps escalating. Secondly, we see from this miracle, the fact that it is a miracle is the fact that it's focused on this word satisfying. Again, from verse 20, it says, they all ate and were satisfied. Think of the crowd. Okay, so we're thinking there's at least 5,000 men. Okay, men normally eat a lot, right? What else could we perhaps conjecture are in the crowd? Who else? Teenage boys, right? Teenage boys are in this crowd. Teenage boys have not only eaten, but they are satisfied. That is a miracle in and of itself. Not only that, but there are leftovers. There are no leftovers around teenage boys, right? There are leftovers. And notice that there are 12 basketfuls, 12 being, I think literally there were 12 basketfuls, but that 12 is symbolic, a complete number. They are completely satisfied. They can't even eat anymore. Then there's the word satisfy itself. The people ate, they all ate, and they were satisfied. Now, this story in many ways compares to Exodus chapter 16. And I'll turn over to Exodus chapter 16. You're welcome to turn there if you want to. But this is where manna is introduced, again, in the wilderness or in the desert. And this is what God says specifically in verse 11 and 12. The Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. It says they will be filled with bread. Now notice, those are two different words, being filled and being satisfied. Now, they're not the same word. They're different words. I could technically, I'm sure, although I've never tried, be full off tofu, but I don't think I would be satisfied with a full belly of tofu. But yet these people are completely satisfied. There are 12 basketfuls, which again, that symbolize that they have been completely satisfied. And notice that they're in a crowd of at least 5,000 people. There's bound to be some foodies, right? Some people that if Gordon Ramsay were to cook a meal for them, would be dissatisfied with it. But yet, it's just bread and fish, which was a poor person's diet, by the way. And yet, those people are satisfied. There's bound to be picky eaters. Now, been working with the youth. You know, we've been here for over 4 years now. And each year, we probably take, you know, at least a couple trips that require that we stop for food. And I think to this point, we've probably had anywhere from like 5 to 13 as we travel along. We have yet to find one stop that satisfies all the picky eaters in my 4 years here. Right? They're always like, no, not that place, no, not that place. 5,000 people, 5,000, at least 5,000 people ate. And again, we go back to this word, they were satisfied. They were filled, yes, but they were satisfied, even the picky eaters in the bunch. Now, this is an impressive miracle. This is certainly an impressive miracle. But why is it in all four Gospels? Because not other than Jesus' final week, hardly anything is in all four Gospels that's recorded. And it recorded with the exact same details, too. The 12 basketfuls, the two loaves, the five loaves, the two fish. Why is it in all four Gospels? Why do all Gospel writers, including Matthew, place such an emphasis on this feeding of the 5,000? Well, it's because it does such a good job of pointing not only backwards, but pointing forwards. Let's discuss how it points backwards. We already mentioned Exodus chapter 16, right? Where God introduces manna, and he introduces manna to his people in this wilderness, in this desert. And so now Jesus, in the very same setting, is saying that he is the new and greater Moses. Well, how is that? Well, it's because Jesus is more than a spokesperson. Remember that Moses was kind of this intermediary, but it's not like he created the manna, right? He went to God. He said, God, the people are having these problems. What should I do? God says, go tell the people I will do this. And so he goes back and relays the message that, hey, there's going to be some manna. He gives them instructions on how to gather it, when you can eat it. Notice Jesus is more than a spokesman. He actually provides the bread himself. He actually provides the fish. He is the multiplier. And not only that, but from Exodus chapter 16, God created a command that the Israelites were to put a piece of the manna in the ark and to keep it as a remembrance so that they would be reminded that God has provided for you, and for a future time where he will once again provide for his people. So they're supposed to pick up on the fact that, wait a second, Jesus is this new manna from God. Jesus is this new bread of life that God is providing. Why? Because he is more than a spokesperson. He is the bread multiplier himself. this miracle points backwards, but it also points forward. It points forward to the Last Supper. Look at verse 19. Again, if you just stopped there, you would almost think that this was the Last Supper. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass, taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven from here. He gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to people. He looks to heaven. He takes the loaves. He breaks it. He blesses it, and he gives. The exact same words and the exact same order as the Last Supper. Jesus would go hungry that we might be satisfied. His body would be broken that ours might be healed. It points forward to the Last Supper. Not only does it point forward to the Last Supper, which was just coming in, depending on the time frame, a year or two from this feeding, but it points forward to this messianic banquet. What's this messianic banquet? Again, from chapter 8, I said chapter 8 was pretty key in understanding this passage. Back in chapter 8, when Jesus heals the man that the centurion was asking, the Roman centurion was asking him to heal, this is what he says when he hears the Roman centurion's response. Verse 11, I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. You see, there was this idea that when the Messiah would come, that eventually there would be this messianic feast, that he would introduce this messianic banquet, and all people would eat, and all people would be satisfied. All people from all nations would be eat. But see, the Jews at this point in time were taken as maybe just the Jews, and maybe just the clean Jews. But in a crowd of 5,000, at least 5,000, you better believe that there were more than just Jews there. And there were certainly more than just clean Jews there. Why? Because we see that Jesus needed to heal some. So some were ceremonially unclean. It points forward to this messianic banquet. Not only does this feeding point forward to the messianic banquet, but also the Last Supper from Matthew chapter 26 in verse 29. This is what Jesus says as he's finishing up the meal. I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. You see, you have a large multitude of people, more than just Jews, and they're reclining. Again, in verse 19, Jesus directed the people to sit down on the grass or to recline. That's really a posture of how they would eat, but specifically a posture of how they would eat at a feast or at a banquet. So, again, we read that it's pointing forward. Jesus, in doing this miracle, is pointing forward to this messianic banquet so that finally we read in Revelation chapter 19, verse 9, Then the angel said to me, Write, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb. And he added, These are the true words of God. So in other words, this wedding supper is this messianic banquet that's going to be in the future, of which this meal points forward to. But yet, the people who ate that day, one day became hungry again. Much in the way that though Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, Lazarus still died eventually. Still, we look to the Lord's Supper in the past, we look to the Lord's Supper in the past, and the messianic banquet in the future to know that satisfaction has been paid in full. The cross 100% guarantees it, and when Jesus returns again, it will be experienced in full. Jesus, in his miracle, provided the satisfactory solution to the correct diagnosis of the problem, that these people were spiritually hungry and sick, and only he could satisfy what they were looking for. And in the same way, we need to look to Christ, not only from the past of what he's done on the cross, but in the future for when he returns at the messianic banquet to provide that full 100% satisfaction. Now, where does this leave us? How does this then really apply to our lives? Well, the first step that I would say, whether you're a Christian or you're not a Christian, is stop seeking satisfaction elsewhere. That you cannot find satisfaction apart from Christ, because you're really left with one of two results. Number one, you're left possibly by being disillusioned, right? The Rolling Stones, I can't get no satisfaction. You're not going to find it apart from Christ, and ultimately, your pursuits frequently leave you disillusioned. Or you could just wear out your shoes in the attempt to find it, because outside of Christ, you won't find it. This is the book that Nick, Megan, and I have been doing. And in it, the people place things up. They prop things up as idols. And frequently they prop satisfaction up as an idol. They might find it temporarily, but they're constantly looking for it. And apart from Christ, it's never going to be fulfilling. And so these are a series of questions I think are brilliantly worded questions that can involve satisfaction. So there's seven of them. Satisfaction. You look beautiful to me right now, but when did you ever leave your place of prominence and glory to humble yourself for me? Satisfaction. When did you ever enter my world to suffer on my behalf? Satisfaction. When did you ever shed your blood so that I could be cleansed from my sin? Satisfaction. When were you ever raised from the dead on my behalf? When did you ever promise to give me new life and power? Satisfaction, when did you ever promise to send me the Holy Spirit to fill me with true satisfaction that would help me to please God even when my earthly satisfaction was threatened? Satisfaction, when did you ever promise to intercede for me to my Father in heaven so that I could be strong in trial? Satisfaction, when did you ever promise to come again and redeem me from the things that capture me and make me their slave? We need to stop seeking satisfaction elsewhere. Again, our physical hunger, our physical sickness are mere built-in, God-ordained feelings that point us to the one who can only provide a satisfactory solution to our hunger, a satisfactory solution to our sickness. And then finally, we see that there is the role of the disciples. Look back to our passage. The role of disciples, again, it's subtle, but it's there nonetheless. Verse 16. Jesus replied, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." Now the "you" there is actually emphatic in Greek, and many scholars are like, "Well, what do they do? What's Jesus saying there? Is he playing some sort of joke on them?" I don't think he's playing a joke. I think he's serious. Not that they're supposed to come up with it, but they're supposed to, again, go to the food source. They're supposed to be the facilitators that offer Jesus to people, that they give people Jesus. They don't cure the hunger themselves, right? Because they're not the food multipliers themselves, but they're supposed to take what Jesus gives and in turn give it to the people. And we do see that that's in fact what they do. In verse 19, then he gave them to the disciples, them being the loaves, and the disciples gave them to the people. So the role of disciples is that we provide, we offer, we facilitate Christ, the bread of life, the eternal water, the eternal springs of water to the people of the world. We offer them Jesus, the one true satisfier of their souls.